Rebonsoir tout le monde et bienvenue à la deuxième partie donc de notre webinaire, de notre séminaire en ligne. C'était exactement 10 minutes comme promis. Et donc, je vais présenter donc la troisième intervenante. Bon, en fait, on va entendre la fille de l'intervenante, mais Anne est là aussi. Alors, il s'agit de Anne Fuchs, qui est un professeur à la retraite, qui a travaillé longtemps à l'université de Nice, maintenant l'université de Côte d'Azur. Et elle a travaillé surtout dans les études de théâtre, et notamment elle a publié le livre « Playing the Market, The Market Theatre Johannesburg » et une série d'autres textes sur le théâtre et le changement en Afrique du Sud, mais aussi sur l'Angleterre et sur la littérature noire et de l'Asie du Sud-Est. Voilà. Et aujourd'hui, en fait, elle va nous parler, donc on va s'amuser parce qu'elle va nous parler de BBC Fiction, le côté comique en fait, ITMA, It's That Man Again, célèbre émission pendant la Deuxième Guerre, jusqu'à Goodness Gracious Me dans les années 90. Alors comme je l'ai indiqué, c'est sa fille qui va lire l'intervention, mais Anne est présente pour éventuellement répondre aux questions, ou d'ailleurs Nadia ou quelqu'un d'autre. Alors voilà, je la vois plus, Nadia. Ah oui, voilà. Ok.
Oui, je suis là.
Voilà. Alors je vous passe la parole, Nadia, et merci de votre aide.
Ok. Je vais partager mon écran. Can everybody see it?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And everybody can hear me?
Yes.
Oui.
So BBC Fiction, from ITMA to Goodness Gracious Me, how wartime radio shows gave birth to TV sitcoms and after. Sorry, I'm just going to change rooms. There's an echo. At the end of World War II, King George VI is famously quoted as having said, "We always listen to it," the it in question being ITMA, It's That Man Again, the radio programme which was first broadcast in July 1939 by the BBC National Programme and lasted until 1949. This comedy programme was centred around the comedian Tommy Handley, who of course constituted one of the various reference to that man. Apparently, the first coining of the expression was by the American Republicans in the 1930s, referring to Franklin D. Roosevelt and his successive New Deal economic measures. In Britain in the 1930s, the phrase was first used and afterwards identified by the wartime radio audience as a reference to Adolf Hitler and his takeover activities. The popularity of the series during wartime Britain was quite phenomenal. The radio audience was estimated at 60 million, or 40% of the population, tuning in every week to a 30-minute programme with approximately 18 minutes of script interspersed with musical interludes. Another feature was that of a very active sound department, and sound not only illustrating script, but also producing comic effects with its own language. How did this successful formula come about? It in fact had developed from a pre-war BBC radio failure. In 1937, it was discovered by the Audience Research Department that the once much listened to dance band shows were losing favour with the radio audiences, And it was decided to change future shows by adding a compere and a resident comedian. Compere Richard Murdoch and well-known comedian Arthur Askey took over the new slots in the first of these new comedy productions. Bandwagon, which premiered in 1937, soon justified the new programming and was a weekly fixture until 1939, when Richard Murdoch left to join the RAF and Askey turned to films and live shows. When Itmar came into being, it retained, in fact, some of the new characteristics of Bandwagon. A comedy situation with the same characters appearing weekly, musical interludes, sound effects producing their own style of comedy, and probably what will be remembered best about the two shows, the use of catchphrases repeated weekly and much appreciated by the studio audiences. In Bandwagon, these catchphrases were still few and far between, as the comic episodes were only played out by the two characters interpreted by Askey and Murdoch, supposedly living together in a top-floor flat at the BBC. Askey's phrases, although recognised and appreciated at the time, have not really lived on, as they all pertain to the actor or character themselves. The most famous of them being his imitation of a London bus conductor saying, "I thank you." Sorry, I'm not very good at that. Murdoch's favourite was addressing his partner as, "You silly little man." Itmar was a programme with a fixed script written by Ted Kavanagh, who created dozens of fictional characters who week after week interrupted the main situational theme, already causing mirth through surprise for the audience and irritation for Tommy Handley and his sidekick, Jack Train. The last two in their various roles were generally already battling the elements, the Germans, or wartime rules and regulations. The pace of the programme was sustained by Handley, who had the most extraordinary fast debit. It was suggested that this was inspired by the Americans' Burns and Allen show. Jack Train, his sidekick, also played the part of one of the most important creations. That is, Funf, the German spy, supposed to be giving a German radio propaganda speech. At the most inappropriate moment, this hollow, threatening voice would cut across everything else with the phrase, "This is Funf speaking." The characters were taken from various walks of life, with a surprisingly wide range of classes and occupations representing British society in the 1940s. The humour was that of two great British traditions, satire and nonsense. As regards satire, the overriding theme satirised was that of the war effort, to which each and every character contributed in his own way, but generally not very successfully. A new element for the British at this period was the sudden appearance of a category which was essential if they were to beat the Germans. This was that of the workers. On radio generally, much was made of the new programmes entitled Music While You Work, addressed to factory workers making munitions every day from 10:30 to 11 a.m. This light and popular music programme was supposed to raise the morale of the workers and thereby increase production in the munitions factory. Strangely enough, like all wartime broadcasting, it was censored. Only cheerful rhythmic tunes were to be heard, with no heavy drum beating, which might distract the workers by making them wonder if this could not be gunfire. The other thus designated programme was workers' playtime, broadcast two or three times a week during the workers' lunch hour. A touring variety show, it visited different towns and works canteens, once more purporting to keep morale high. These worker programmes were in no way a criticism or satire of working-class popular culture, but were more in line with the popular radio culture of the 1920s and 30s. If, in the case of the workers as a group, satire would at the time have been counterproductive to the war effort. Itamar did not hesitate to use satire and nonsense in the portrayal of individuals belonging to the working class. This said, was the most popular satirized figure even a member of what a Marxist of the time would have categorized as working class? The best remembered figure of comic fiction from World War II was a charlady, or as my mother would have said, my help, ironically named Mrs. Mop. She had two catchphrases. Interrupting Tommy Handley, she would suddenly be heard saying, "Can I do you now, sir?" with a slight double entendre. Her other catchphrase when she left was, "Ta-ta for now," which soon became TTFN, an expression which caught on for all and sundry for most of the 20th century. Mrs. Mop's influence was such that it was recording during the air raids that, I quote, "Hearing a warden pass, a small boy in Bath who was trapped under the rubble of what had once been a home called out, 'Can you do me now, sir?' And TTFN was sometimes the last intelligible phrase uttered by people who are dying in hospital." These examples of catchphrases stem from a point of view which is always one of the status quo, otherwise the British class system, which pervaded without being questioned the BBC hierarchy from its foundations until the great state reforms in education and health at the end of the war. But Itamar, as we have said, was in fact part of a morale-building war effort, so the upper classes themselves came in for a fair amount of ridicule. The colonel was a prime example, his whole life based on his addiction to drink, and his catchphrase regularly intervening to say thank you for a supposed offer of a drink. "I don't mind if I do." As for the only non-white character in Itamar, he is not yet an immigrant, but a travelling salesman, probably of Middle Eastern origin, called Ali Oop, with the catchphrase, "I go, I come back," who tries to sell Tommy Handley, amongst other things, photographs of naked women. Another character, probably personifying the poor, badly paid and difficult jobs, is the diver, who seems to emerge from the sea saying, "Don't forget the diver, sir." The whole effect came from the sound department, who introduced the character with the sound of loud bubbles. As for Tommy Handley himself, who combined with Ted Kavanagh and Francis Worsley to write a topical script each week, the satire was in the nonsensical situations evoked by his successive functions and places of work. First, in the Ministry of Aggravation and Mysteries, where he headed the Office of Twerps, then as mayor of foaming at the mouth and manager of an ammunition factory. The satire was essentially against all the wartime rules and regulations, the blackout, etc. Towards the end of the war, following on from this very topical satire, Arthur Askey's former partner, Richard Murdoch, after his demob from the RAF, devised with Kenneth Horne a very different program about an RAF station in 1944 entitled Much Binding in the Marsh. The title was no doubt referring to the actual RAF station at Moreton in the Marsh in Gloucestershire, and binding, a reference to the RAF slang expression meaning complaining or whinging. If the popularity of this radio show was also enormous at the time, it was for other reasons. More of a situation comedy based on a realistic situation, it made up for its lack of fast-talking nonsense of Itamar by a brilliant musical contribution at the end, whereby the happenings of each episode were described and summarized in verse to the catchy, much-binding signature tune. These wartime programs were to continue until the end of the 1940s, in particular with Take It From Here, from 1948 to 1960. Starting broadcasting in 1948, before the death of Tommy Handley in 1949, it nevertheless was almost a sequel to Itamar and was almost as popular. Writers Dennis Norden and Frank Muir finally adopted a new formula of three acts: a Nitmar-like discussion, a musical interlude, and third, a short situation comedy, the situation first taken from literature or history, and from 1953 onwards, figuring an up-to-date family, the Glums. As one critic put it, the Glums were a send-up of nice families, such as the Archers, a radio soap opera broadcast from 1941 to the present day. The first British sitcom as such is recognised today as being Hancock's Half Hour. It was a comedy situation exploited by comedian Tommy Hancock, and in the tradition of Itmar, his sidekick Sid James. A weekly half-hour programme broadcast first on the radio, 1954-56, and then on television, 1956-61. This was an up-to-date comedy situation with an out-of-work actor living at a fictitious London address, 23 railway cuttings East Cheam. Most of Cheam, however, is a middle-class district, and there was a little of the latest sitcom's theme of keeping up with the Joneses. Various real contemporary situations were exploited. The return of petrol rationing during the Suez Crisis of 1956-57 and the railway strike of 1955. And as sitcoms would become, the reactions of the various more or less eccentric characters to the situation. The overriding influence of Itmar from the 1950s onwards can be split into two very different streams of fictional comedy: that of the absurdist nonsensical tradition, and secondly, that of the new situation comedy, where all depends on the social and political situations of the time. It is interesting that various books about radio television comedy and even the numerous articles on the web, as far as the absurdist stream is concerned, fail to mention Itmar. According to most accounts, the nonsensical, surrealist or absurd humour of the 20th century is dated back to the Goon Show of the 1950s. It began with two actors who had met in the war, Spike Milligan and Harry Secombe, coming together in a new series of half-hour sketches and music with Peter Sellers and Michael Bontine. The series developed over the decade, with the music becoming less and the individual sketches now linked with a general theme. Although not reproducing the fast talking of Tommy Handley, there were absurd situations, nonsensical jokes, and perhaps even greater attention to the sound effects. Shutting and opening of doors was non-stop and did not always correspond with entrances and exits. The bubbles of Itmar's Don't Forget the Diver became ever present, representing characters' digestive problems. And more original, the characters were supposedly housed within pianos with appropriate piano noises. The absurd was also carried on into the music with the Yin Tong song. The Goon Show of the 1950s and Monty Python's Flying Circus of the 1960s became cult series for the future, whereas Itmar was only remembered for its numerous catchphrases. One reason was that the wartime situation was becoming more and more incomprehensible to audiences who were no longer living through it. Monty Python's Flying Circus was also part of a much wider development on radio and television. BBC broadcasting in the 1960s was taken over by public schoolboys, subsequently students at Oxford or Cambridge, where they took part in amateur satirical shows such as the well-known Cambridge Footlights. These young performers had no real connections with the war effort, but had everything to look forward to in a blooming Britain, where all could benefit from the new welfare state and prosperous business enterprises. The class system was still unchanged, but parallel to it was a new liberated class intending to bypass old traditions, making their name through the theatre and its angry young men and the new medium of television. The television star David Frost was a former member of Footlights, who began his career with the 1962 satiric sketch show This Was the Week That Was, followed by Not So Much a Program, More a Way of Life in 1964 and 1965, going on to become host of the Frost Report in 1966. In late night intellectual shows, the satire had often been influenced by the absurd. Monty Python's Flying Circus, with the same category of writers, actors, and producers, was devoted to the absurd while being strongly influenced by their intellectual education. They were showing the absurdity of the old fixed lifestyle through satire. John Cleese, after having taken part in the Frost programs, we see John Cleese here, with other Oxford and Cambridge graduates, wrote, produced, and played in Monty Python's Flying Circus, following the formulas of the Goon Show, but introducing cultural references to literature, philosophy, art, etc. The sketches, at first not linked, were gradually tied together with what Cleese and critics called a stream of consciousness, another very literary allusion. This absurd humour continued through the 20th century, explaining perhaps the roots of such television programmes as Mr. Bean, first broadcast on ITV in 1989. The other stream, having its origins in the wartime comedy programmes, was that of the sitcom, as we have said, starting in the 1950s. For the first time, there was a realistic portrayal of the everyday lives and language of the lower classes. This was now accompanied by the theme of the generation gap. Steptoe and Son was a sitcom involving the everyday life of a rag and bone merchant, played by comedian Harry Corbett, and his elderly father, played by comedian William Bramble. No longer a programme of sketches, each 40-minute episode was centred on a particular situation or problem, always involving a disgraceful old father only interested in the pleasures of life, and the son trying to, what used to be called, better himself. This meant trying to speak BBC English, mixed with a higher social class, attempts at acquiring some kind of culture, etc., and hiding his misbehaving and disreputable father from prospective girlfriends. Another generational sitcom with more explicit political overtones was the 1965-1975 Till Death Us Do Part, the title being a quotation from the Church of England marriage vows. At the time, this sitcom was attacked by the far-right Mary Whitehouse, a protector of traditional morals, as well as by the left. Alf Garnett, the main character, is what the press called a working-class conservative and is always in conflict with the rest of his family and in particular with his son-in-law, a socialist from Liverpool that he accuses of being a scouse git. Johnny Spate, who said he had written the series in order to combine racism, was later alarmed that this Cogney bigot who supported Enoch Powell could be influencing television spectators to agree with the racists. The series was indeed such a success that the BBC in 1985 showed a spin-off with the same characters in their old age, entitled In Sickness and in Health, another quotation from the marriage vows. Alf's wife dies and his daughter gets divorced. Alf is then shown with a gay black home help named Winston. The racist language of Alf became such that the BBC in 1988 was obliged to phase out the character of Winston and to deliver an altogether milder version of the show. However, to go back to the 60s, indeed in 1968, as if to escape from the present or almost to obliterate it, there was a new sitcom which also had elements of class and generation conflict, but which realistically ignored the present time with a return to the war years. Dad's Army contains in its very title the concept of generation, purporting as it does to speak of the past, but by the use of the familiar term dad already poking gentle fun, the notion of dad not normally associated with army. Sorry about the poor quality of the picture. then who's dead? Probably not that of the present, i.e. 1968 generation, but rather the dads of the 1939-45 war heroes who did not themselves go to war, but kept the home fires burning. The ridicule and humor of the sitcom were not, except one exception, aimed at generational conflict between the characters, but rather used psychological whimsy and the mocking of class differences. The odd man out was not yet a black immigrant, but rather a Scot, and how prophetic that seems today. They all belonged to a defense institution which, as were the ARP, Air Raid Protection, and the specials, policemen who were special in that they had other jobs and only intervened in wartime emergencies, were supposed to protect the civilians. Harking back to Itmar, the characters were drawn from all walks of life, and we are not just concerned with one family or milieu, as it seems to be with the other sitcoms already cited. I use the term whimsy rather than surrealist or absurd, as the situations and the language are completely realistic, and it's only because of the foibles and especially misunderstanding of the characters that they provoke humour. Dad's Army is probably one of the best-remembered sitcoms today, as it has had numerous revivals, perhaps due to two factors. One is the fact of the intermittent interest in the Second World War. The other is the gentle mocking of the middle classes and their efforts of heroism, which can be compared with Beaumont's Night of the Burning Pestle at the beginning of the 17th century. There is also much of the anti-hero in John Cleese's second great sitcom, Fawlty Towers, 1968-79. Here we have completely left behind the new young intellectuals of Monty Python's Flying Circus to be told the story of Basil Fawlty and his wife Sybil in their attempts to run successfully a talky hotel with their acolytes Polly the maid and Manuel the Spanish waiter. John Cleese gives a never-to-be-forgotten performance as the incompetent, snobbish and unlucky hotel owner, and the new theme not of the British abroad, but of the British reception of the relatively new mingling of foreign visitors and workers in a pretentious middle-class environment. The script by Cleese and Connie Booth, who also played the part of the maid, was brilliant, and the sitcom was voted the best British television programme of all times in one of the numerous best polls, even though the BBC had been dubious about its reception. In the 1970s, as well as well into the 1980s and beyond, the British class system, which in fact right up until today has little changed, with the economic boom was more and more confronted with a generation struggling to get on in life or changing their status. It is also in the beginning a desire to get rich, such as in Only Fools and Horses from 1991, to 2003. What is interesting is that in the next group of sitcoms, there seems to be a transition, riches to status. In Britain in this period, it seems that money can't buy everything. In Birds of a Feather, the change appears with Doreen, who, already rich, does everything to ingratiate herself with the great and famous. Here, the satire is rather directed towards the search for notoriety, of which class is only one element. Finally, those who want to change or preserve their class status as their main aim in life, or at least their class status in the eyes of others, appear in the extraordinary satires of Keeping Up Appearances, 1990 to 1995, and Ab Fab, 1992 to 2012. In the former, housewife Hyacinth Bucket dedicates her existence to just that, keeping up appearances, obliging all and sundry to pronounce her surname Bucket as Bouquet, and terrifying her friend and neighbour Elizabeth into having accidents with her royal Dalton tea service. Hyacinth drives her long-suffering husband Richard into bursts of revolt. If Hyacinth's aim is to show that she can keep up with the middle classes, or at least to how she perceives them, in Lab Fab or Absolutely Fabulous, we see a classless jet set trying to keep up with the rich and famous. Originating in a sketch by two well-known female comedians, Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders, the latter wrote the script for the sitcom Ab Fab. She also played the part of the main character, Adina, an inveterate drunk, who has a best friend, Patsy, a drug addict, played by Joanna Lumley. If Ab Fab was a great success and rapidly got onto the American market, the two or three last sitcoms we want to mention were something quite different and concern what is almost the new generation of the over-80s. It was perhaps the time in 1990 when it was realized that there were more and more viewers of television living into their 80s or even into their 90s. One Foot in the Grave from 1990 to 2000 is about a rather objectionable old man, Victor Meldew, who's scheming and trying to put one over the neighbors is the worry of his long-suffering wife. Waiting for God, 1990 to 1994, on the other hand, is about a feisty old lady in an old people's home where she insists on having her own way and incites rebellion in the other inmates. These include her boyfriend, who eventually marries her. The satire in both these sitcoms is directed at the old people themselves, but also essentially at the little understanding shown by those around them. Also in 1992, a third comedy might be placed in the same category, although in As Time Goes By, from 1992 to 2005, the characters are slightly younger and less of a caricature. A couple meet again after 38 years of separation and learn to know each other, but also the families each has had while apart. Something which seems to have been a constant during the period 1939-1995 is that the sitcom in all its versions was a reflection of life in Britain, with the mental attitudes, evolving political situations, and continuing class differentials experienced in reality. This perhaps came to a head and was epitomized at the beginning of the following period in Matt Lucas's and David Walliams' Little Britain from 2003 to 2006, which brought together the absurd and a reflection on the times we lived in. We can note that this satirical caricature of the foibles and indeed madness of the British people was taken off the air in repeats of 2020 following complaints about characters being played in blackface, complaints which of course are a reflection of our present times. Fictional realism, in the case of the sitcom as we have seen, depended very much on the situation, but a situation to Britain at a given period. From Itmar to Waiting for God, however, comedy depended on the unlikely characteristics of the British people, and we may add, was not always understood by the American or Commonwealth audiences. The formula seemed to work at home with both radio and television reception, and surprisingly, numerous sitcoms passed easily from one media to the other. As we have sometimes pointed out, some sitcoms were successful in other English-speaking countries, rarely in translation. One last remark. It might be said that the BBC, with other means of finance, national rather than multinational, has no need to go with the times and the all-pervading series. But they are in competition with all the other independent or world-finance-dependent channels, and so, of course, follow the trend towards globalization. It is, however, to their credit that they go on with the sitcom tradition, reflecting British comedy of the day with the new immigrant society, taking its place through, notably, The Goodness Gracious Me and The Kumars at number 42, sitcoms starring the comedian Sanjeev Bhaskar and Meera Syal. I am not sure that these would go down very well on a Japanese or South American market. Sorry, I haven't been watching the time.
You don't...
Have I still got time to show the...
Yes, you have.
Yes, okay. So I'll just change screens. So this is just the beginning of the Itmar show from
Throwaway 2, carry 9, flyaway Peter, flyaway 4, apples, a pound, pears, watermelons, we have not put down those plums. Now it's no good. I shall have to raise the rates again. Hello?
This is Pump speaking.
Oh, Pump call, eh?
Beware, Mr. Mayor. Your end is in sight.
Good Lord, is my shirt hanging out?
You won't hang out much longer, Henry. Food will get you. Food has spoken.
Oh, go and strain your cabbage water. He can't frighten me.
Says you.
Let me see, where was I? Oh, 10 bob to come back from the dogs. 2 shillings for second-hand suite tickets. And then, hey, where are you going?
This way to the stables.
That's right, straight through and up the stairs. This place is about as private as a cup final. What am I talking about? We haven't got any stables. Hey!
Excuse?
Well, if it isn't old ping-pong bats, what do you want?
Please, mister, you give me permission to pedal on your pier?
Certainly not.
Any other town I pedal or a lad?
Well, you can't pedal here. It upsets my curriculum.
Oh, pity. You know me, what? Mr. P. I sell you a very nice coffee on you. Very pongy, very fishy.
No, thanks. I don't smoke.
Don't like him?
No.
No, Mr. P.
What?
You buy a nice, pretty postcard. Very pretty lady. Very warm. Very saucy.
How dare you? Let's have a look.
No. 4 shillings for look.
I wouldn't give you 4 pence for the lot. Oh. Now go on, hop it. And don't darken my day dough again.
Oh, Mr. P. Mr. P. I go... I come back.
I don't care if you never come back. And now back to the chitling. These marbles are leading me up the wrong alley. I'll try my Wall Street account. Now, let me see. Bears, 2 bears, 4 bulls, 2 nanny goats. Price pudding, if it comes down, divide by 16. Move to the right in 4s. And the...
Can I do you now, sir?
Well, crack me on the cranium. If it isn't Mrs. Moth, the child with the bottomless bucket.
Can I ring you out, sir?
What do you think I am, the old year?
I think you're an old rascal, sir.
You'll be reading my diary.
I've brought this for you, sir.
Ah, my robe of office. Help me on with it, Mrs. Moth. I'm expecting a summons at any moment.
Oh, another of them nasty things, sir.
I mean from the council chamber. I believe they wish to pay me the
honour. Oh, then I can have me back wages, sir.
Pay me the honour of re-electing me for a further term. Don't jump to conclusions. Now go easy round Tappenham Corner.
I've lent you the rent in the rear, sir.
Yes, and you've brushed up all the banquet stains. I shan't get any more till after the war. And the vintage ones, too. Now, where's my chain of office?
I've seen it like you, sir.
It was.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So that was Anne's paper read by Nadia, and what I thought was really interesting about that is it seems that a huge number of sitcoms are about worrying about class. and worrying about status. Anybody would think it was a national obsession. I had a question then for Anne or for Nadia, whichever. I wondered why are they, what do they do for the reader? Sorry, what do they do for the viewer or the listener? Because obviously they're not, in some ways they're not that funny, or perhaps it's why are they funny? Especially the ones about the tension about class and status. I don't know if you have anything more to say about that. Otherwise, if people have questions, don't hesitate. We do have one.
Let's answer that.
Well, I'm not sure that I can answer that. I have always found them very funny myself. You're asking me why. I think it is because of this combination of satire and nonsense. I think we all appreciate the satire as referring to our own situation at a given time. And we accept that it's satire. We accept that there is something wrong or something funny with our present times. And I think the nonsense, I mean, if you think of Lewis Carroll and people like that, it is a great British tradition, which British people appreciate. And I'm not sure, I don't know whether Nadia cut two or three bits. I'm not sure whether she said that. I don't think that British humour is always appreciated abroad. I'm sorry, it's not a very good answer.
That's